This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Celebrated every year on the 2nd of February, World Wetlands Day marks the date of the adoption of the Convention on Wetlands, which happened on the same day back in 1971 in the Iranian city of Ramsar on the shores of the Caspian Sea. So wetlands are vital for humans, for other ecosystems, and for our climate, providing essential ecosystem services such as water regulation, which includes flood control and water purification. Wetlands also absorb carbon dioxide and help slow global heating and reduce pollution. Though they cover only around 6% of the Earth's land surface, 40% of all plant and animal species live or breed in wetlands. The worrying thing is that they are disappearing three times faster than forests due to human activities and also global heating. So for a quick 101 on why wetlands are so important, here's an excerpt from an interview we did on Earth Matters back in 2016, where Lee Chui Lin spoke to Associate Professor Catherine Yule, an aquatic biologist, to discuss the relevance and vital role of wetlands in our collective future. So Professor Catherine starts off by explaining what wetlands are.
Basically, wetlands are just areas of land that are saturated with water. So this includes all sorts of things, rivers, lakes, swamps, paddy fields, fish ponds. But the way I think of wetlands, it's basically lakes and swamps. The still waters are the important ones. In Peninsular Malaysia, this would include, there's five different categories. It would be Tasik Chini and Tasik Bera, which are the freshwater swamps created, or freshwater lakes created when the rivers flood, and then mangrove swamps, Malaluka swamps, peat swamps, and also artificial wetlands. And in Malaysia, we have a lot. We have all the tin mine lakes, which is over 4,000, and also the dams, such as Tasik Kenya, also Klang Gates Reservoir, where we get our water from.
Out of curiosity, before we move on, I'm curious about this. Why are wetlands often viewed as wasteland? I mean, is it their appearance? Is it the fact that, you know, people don't use them as farmland? I mean, what is it?
Okay, a lot of wetlands are very hard to get into, like mangrove swamps is very muddy. You can walk in and just go up to your knees in mud, or peat swamps, really hard to walk into. So people don't enter them. They're not the sort of place where they go for a picnic. And what's more, mangrove swamps are at the bottom of rivers, estuaries, and they get filled up with rubbish. All the rubbish that people throw into the rivers ends up in mangrove swamps, so they look like rubbish dumps. And so people don't value them. They don't see them as somewhere worthwhile. They don't understand the ecosystem services that these wetlands provide us.
And how do wetlands differ from each other? I would imagine that something like Tasik Chini is completely different from a tin mining spot.
Yeah, they're very, very different. In fact, we're really lucky in Malaysia that we have such an incredible diversity of wetlands. So, for example, Tasik Chini and Tasik Bera are just the seasonal lakes that rise and fall with the changing, with the wet and the dry season. They're just the rivers kind of expand out to create a series of lakes and then they shrink back again. So these are fresh water and very high in nutrients and very rich, very productive. And then the artificial wetlands, also fresh water, but tin mine lakes is just depressions left behind from tin mining. Dams, Tasik Kenya is just where you dam a river and it fills up, same with Klang Gates. So these tend to have be quite rich ecosystems and fresh water and lots of fish, but artificial. Then we have the mangrove swamps. These are really important to protect our coastlines. They're specialised plants, specialised trees that grow between the ocean and the land, and they protect our land because of that. And what happens is when rivers bring down sediment, they bring down mud from the mountains and things, and this gets trapped by the mangrove trees, trapped in their roots. And so the mangroves actually start building up land out seawards, so they grow and grow. They can grow 100 metres in just a few years. They grow really fast. So by having mangroves, the land of Malaysia is increasing. But these are salt water, so it's sort of brackish water, salt water. And so only very special species can live there. But they're very rich ecosystems because of all the nutrients coming down from the mountains. So they have fish, and they're nurseries for fish and prawns, very important. And lots of other species can live there. So these are very important. They protect us from tsunamis and storms and things. Then we have something that most people don't know about, the Melaleuca swamps. These are small areas of swamps that are found mostly in Terengganu, north of Kuantan, and they form behind sandhills. and very fragile. They've got mostly Melaleuca trees growing in them, and that most of them have been destroyed actually because they are so fragile growing on sand, and they just, people, you can't really use them for agriculture because they're sandy and acidic, but they're used for development. Then there's the peat swamps, and these are the ones that are most important in my eyes. In Indonesia and Malaysia, we have the largest extent of tropical peat swamp forests in the world. They're the largest extent, the most biodiverse, and the deepest peat. So these form where you have depressions, typically coastal behind a mangrove swamp, and the forest, because water's not flowing in, it becomes very nutrient poor. And so the trees try to conserve their nutrients. They have very tough, toxic leaves. And when the leaves fall, they fall into this anoxic, still water, and they don't break down. So they start building up layer upon layer of peat, and they can build up to 20 metres of peat over maybe 5,000 to 10,000 years. So we have this incredible soil of peat. It's just this brown, fibrous matter with very little mineral matter in it at all. But this peat, it's actually used as a fuel. If you dry it out, you can burn it, and that's what happens when it is dried out. It burns. So we have vast areas of peat swamp in Sarawak, and also there used to be a lot around Johor. Now we just have some in Selangor and Pahang left. Most of it's all gone. It's all been cleared and drained. And it's a big shame because it's so important globally because it's the richest terrestrial carbon store in the world. There's not just nothing else like it. And nearly all of our peat swamps have been, there's nothing pristine left because if you drain even a tiny bit around the edge, the whole sponge of peat drains. So what's been happening is that first of all, they drain them, then they cut the trees for the timber, and then they typically will burn it in order to clear the last of the waste because that's the cheapest way. And this is why we get our seasonal fires. So we have the seasonal haze every year when they burn this peat. And it's terrible because we're losing so much carbon just going up into the atmosphere. And yet the agricultural land's not that good. Peat doesn't grow very well. It's very nutrient poor. It's very acidic. It's very unstable. If you see oil palms growing on peat, they bend over. And eventually the peat will degrade. Once it's cleared, it starts to break down because the microbes start working. And physically it just starts breaking down and burns regularly. And eventually the peat will go down, down, down until you reach the mineral soil and you can't grow anything on that. So it's unsustainable. Eventually, agriculture doesn't work on peat land. It might take 50 years, but it just won't stay as agriculture. So it's a big shame. They should just keep them as peat swamp forests.
From a scientific point of view, how does colour play a role in wetland science?
Okay, it's very interesting from my point of view. What happens when you make a cup of tea, you put tea leaves into the water and the water turns brown, and this is from the tannins coming out of the water. So where you have a still wetland, which is very still, and you don't have water coming in, when the leaves fall, it makes the water brown. So two of the wetlands that I spoke about, the Melaleuca swamps and the peat swamps, the water's brown. For simply that reason, it doesn't flow out. It's like a cup of tea. The browner it is, the more carbon is in the water, and the more acidic it is, and the more tannin-rich. And it's actually quite toxic, actually. It's like when you have a cup of tea, if you let it seep for too long, it makes you feel quite sick when you drink it because of all the tannins. So the freshwater swamps like Tasik Bera, Tasik Chini, the Tin Mine Lakes, it's also the mangroves, it's clear water, apart from if it becomes muddy from sediment. So it doesn't have this brownness to it.
I understand that wetlands can be seasonal too. Is that what you were talking about earlier with the rains and with the rising and falling?
Yeah, well, Tasik Bera and Tasik Chini are perfect examples of seasonal lakes. They rise and fall with the wet and the dry seasons. But even in the peat swamp forest, what happens is that they're always wet like a sponge. The peat is always wet. But during the rainy season, they can flood up to a metre or more above the surface of the peat. And that means that the trees in peat swamps are particularly interesting because they have to have breathing roots, they have to have stilt roots, like mangrove trees too, but mangrove, it's a tidal rise and fall. They don't have the seasonal change. Melaleuca swamps also seasonal. They get bigger in the wet season, smaller in the dry season.
So can you make a determination if the soil is wetland soil on site alone?
Well, if the soil's wet, it's probably a wetland. But it's the plants that grow on the soil that will really tell you if it's truly a wetland soil, because they have to be able to survive. So they have to have things like breathing roots and stilt roots. So that will be typical of a wetland plant.
So what are the functions and benefits of wetlands for people and wildlife?
Okay, well, globally, one of the most important functions is the fact that they store carbon. I was explaining about how peat builds up to 20 metres deep. So this dead organic material in the soil is hugely important in the global carbon cycle. So when you destroy a wetland, you're releasing all this carbon and increasing global warming. But also, all the coastal wetlands are important in protecting the coasts. Tsunamis, storms, also sea level rise. As the sea levels are rising, we're going to have more and more erosion of the coast, but by having the wetlands there, that will help to protect them. The other thing is prevention of flooding. Like if Tassic Berra and Tassic Chini weren't there, then all the water would just immediately flood down the Pahang River and start flooding Kuantan. That wouldn't be such a good thing. Peats in particular, peat holds 5 to 10 times its weight in water, so it's an incredibly efficient sponge. If you clear the peat swamp forest, all the water that falls on that land will just flow down and flood any villages and towns downstream of it. And also the fact that they're like a sponge, it means they slow down flood waters. So if there is a huge downpour, it won't come all at once. So the trees keep the water, the peat holds back the water, all important. The other thing is diversity, biodiversity. We are in the tropics, which is naturally biodiverse anyway, but these wetlands are particularly interesting. The fact that we have these peat swamps that aren't found anywhere else in the world, we have species here that aren't found anywhere else in the world. My students and I have found new species of insects, new species of microbes, new species of fungi, new species of algae, and let alone that we're finding new species of trees and things like this as well. The numbers of species of fish in the peat swamps are more than the whole of Europe, so huge numbers, and some very interesting ones. The smallest fish in the world occurs in our peat swamp forests.
How small is that fish?
Oh, it could fit on your thumb and you just across your thumb. It's like a centimetre long. It's tiny, really, really little. It wouldn't make much of a dinner. And also, one thing about the peat swamps is that they're really hard to walk into. Whenever I go in, you get covered with spines and, you know, you come out covered in blood, basically, because all the trees are protected with thorns and spines, and there's lots of hornets and ants and things. So it means that they're a very good refuge for endangered species because hunters and poachers don't like to go in there. So particularly in Borneo and Sumatra, there's orangutans, there's tigers, we have elephants, tapirs, leopards, rhinoceroses, all these different animals that find a refuge in the peat swamps because they're safe from hunting there. In our peat swamps, over 50% of the mammals and nearly a third of the birds are on the IUCN list of globally endangered species. So they're very important for protecting our wildlife.
That unpleasantness that you describe, you know, of walking into a wetland or a swamp and, you know, not enjoying necessarily the whole process, is that part of what makes this whole idea of making wetlands appealing? Is that part of what makes it difficult, the fact that they aren't beautiful, you know, in a sort of more mainstream, understandable way?
Oh, definitely, yes. It's not the sort of place that you can bring you know, a party of government officials and say, hey, we need to protect this because it's so lovely. You know, they can understand the charismatic animals like orangutans and things, but you wouldn't want to bring them into a peat swamp to see them because they would not appreciate that at all. So, yes, it is difficult, but, you know, it's a benefit in that it keeps people out, but it's also a problem because they don't appreciate them, definitely.
With that said, then, what is the process of trying to get people to appreciate them? Because as you say, charismatic animals are popular, you know, for a very good reason, because they're easy to relate to.
It's difficult. It really is. I mean, you have to, people have to understand that they need clean water. They need clean air. They need flood-free environments. They need the ecosystem services. They need to stop global warming. But, you know, I guess people in the Maldives, they can see global warming happening. They can see the sea level rising. But unless they actually see it and feel it and touch it, it's not always that simple. But one thing, the haze. Everybody, I think now they're not forgetting the haze between haze events, especially this last one. It was so bad. And we're going to have haze again this year. And when you are breathing in the haze particles, you're breathing in these tiny particles, you're actually breathing in peat swamp forest. You're breathing in tiny particles of peat, and it has incredibly bad health impacts. Like, there's spikes in death rates when we have the haze. You know, children are dying, old people are dying, sick people who are already sick are dying. And when we can't have water for 2 days at a time, I'm hoping that people will start to value these things. And I think with the rise in the middle class, as people become middle class, they start to want clean water and clean air and a good environment, and they start to get these understandings. It's not just a scrabble for survival anymore. So I'm hoping it will turn around.
In your view, is Malaysia suffering from too much wetland loss?
Oh, it's appalling. It's so sad. It breaks my heart. It really does. It's so sad. We are losing so much, and it's getting lost before people even realise. So yes, far, far too much loss. And the damage, you know, rehabilitation is a difficult process. Sometimes it can't be done.
And you mentioned climate change. How will climate change impact the biodiversity that we see in wetlands?
Well, a lot of the wetlands will vanish. The coastal wetlands will vanish with rising sea levels. Already, mangroves are getting eroded. Where people have cleared the peat swamp forests in parts of Sarawak and turned them into oil palms, already they're starting to flood. Normally, if you have 20 metres of peat, that's raised peat. So that means that you're preventing the sea level being able to come in because you've got higher land. But when it starts shrinking, the sea level will rise and flood, and that's what's happening. So it's happening. With regard to changing temperatures, we don't know so much about what will happen. It's hard to predict, but it probably won't be good.
Are there any species that we know of that are especially threatened?
There's a lot of species. I mean, any species that is living in a peat swamp is in jeopardy, without a doubt, because if the peat swamps are gone, most of them don't live in other habitats because it's such an extreme and unusual environment. And one group of organisms that people aren't that familiar with would be the microbes. In extreme environments, you have microbes that you don't have anywhere else in the world. Our studies have shown over 40% of microbes in North Slang or peat swamp forests are new to science. And a lot, we've already found some that produce antimicrobial compounds that are active against golden staph and other very dangerous infections. So we're going to be losing these because they can't live anywhere else because there's no other habitat like it. So, yeah, it's a big problem, let alone the orangutans. We know they're vanishing. Tigers, rhinoceros, we know they're vanishing.
You've talked a little bit about water quality and, of course, about the importance of that, especially in a place where, as you say, we've experienced water shortages. We experience these things for ourselves. Can you have good water quality without protecting wetlands?
Oh, definitely not. Definitely not. Just by destroying them in themselves, you're going to be getting, for example, you destroy the mangroves, all that mud is going to go somewhere, and typically it will go onto the coral reefs, which are offshore of the mangrove swamps. So that mud is devastating for coral reefs. Already, if you go around Port Dickson or Langkawi, coral reefs around there, they're all sediment impacted. So, yeah, it's not a good thing for our water quality, definitely not.
What are some of the things you'd like to see being done right now in order to support or protect the wetlands in Malaysia?
I think the main thing is that people need to understand the economic value of their ecosystem services, the economic value of flood protection, the economic value of no haze, the economic value of clean water and clean air, the economic value of mitigating climate change. Enormous, enormous value, far, far greater than the value that we get from timber or the value that we get from prawn farms or the value that we get from even oil palm. With these, some people get some money, but with ecosystem services, everyone on the planet benefits. So far greater benefit.
Of course, it's, you know, as we talked earlier, it's easier to see the benefit of things that are easy to understand or palatable. But for you, what is your vision for a wisely used wetland? Are we just to leave it? Is that how we best use it?
My ideal would be, yes, yes, please just leave it. In a perfect world, we would leave it. In the past, the traditional owners used the wetlands very wisely. The Orang Asli living in Pekan peat swamp forest in Pahang, they used it very wisely. They didn't destroy it, and they still got their entire livelihoods from the forest. And we can still get benefits in terms of selective logging. We can get various forest products, we can get the microbes for bioprospecting, all this sort of thing. We can get so much from intact wetlands. So as much as possible, we should leave them. And furthermore, every wetland needs a buffer zone. Not only just protecting the wetland itself, you need to have a buffer of vegetation, native vegetation around each wetland to truly protect it, to protect it from pollution, to protect it from sediment flowing in, from land clearing, that sort of thing. So yes, I have a vision that would be very different to what's happening today.
So if we have a policymaker then who's faced with the dilemma of whether or not to grow rice or to clear out something for the sake of agriculture or for the sake of business versus conserving a wetland, what advice would you be giving him or her?
Well, I would first of all look at the world today. We have a problem with obesity, a huge problem with obesity. Do we need more rice? Actually, no. The food problem in the world today is one of distribution. There is plenty of food for everybody. There is an overabundance of food. People waste food. I think about a third of food that's produced is wasted. So no, we don't need more rice paddies. We don't need more oil palm. Yes, people want the money, but it's not the answer. We need to distribute things more fairly, definitely.
And when it comes to making these decisions, there are various knowledge tools available to different countries, available to people in the position to make changes, I think, in various countries, policymakers and so on. But would you say that the application of these tools perhaps remain a challenge?
Oh, totally. We have the answers. We do know. We do know the truth. There's scientists out there, NGOs out there. We know what should be done. The problem really is one of greed, unfortunately. I think people choose not to make the wisest decisions because it's not the decision that suits them personally the best. Their short-term financial gain tends to be the most important thing in their minds.
Finally then, if we want to improve the state of the wetlands that we have, of the protection that they're being offered, and of, I guess, the degradation that we're currently seeing, how can we mainstream their values or mainstream their value in the decision-making process?
Well, I think all EIAs, all environmental impact assessments, need to take into consideration the ecosystem, the value of the ecosystem services. It needs to be valued, and it's not that hard to do. We have the tools to value these. It needs to be part of the process, and it needs to be part of the legislation that it's part of the process.
That was Associate Professor Catherine Yule, an aquatic biologist, discussing the importance of wetlands in an interview from 2016. And coming up after this quick break, we're going to revisit another interview, this time from 2018, this one about mangrove swamps, which are coastal wetlands. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs, and it was World Wetlands Day yesterday, and so we're revisiting past interviews that we've done on Earth Matters to help us understand the importance of wetlands better. So earlier we heard from Associate Professor Catherine Yule, an aquatic biologist, about the importance of wetlands in general, and now we're going to zoom in on mangroves, which are coastal wetlands. So back in 2018, I spoke to Dr. Ahmad Aldri Amir, who's a senior lecturer and research fellow at the Institute for Environment and Development, or Lestari, at University Kebangsaan, Malaysia, and he's also the coordinator of the Malaysian Mangrove Research Alliance and Network, also known as My Mangrove. So here's part of that interview, which starts off with Dr. Aldri explaining the characteristics of a mangrove forest.
First of all, they would only prefer sheltered coastline in the tropic and subtropic zone, within the intertidal zone. Mm-hmm. So they prefer zones are just slightly above mean sea level. So that is one thing, particular unique thing about mangrove. And secondly, they are halophytes. They are salt-loving creatures, salt-loving plants. So not many plants have this ability to tolerate salt. They are bringing good benefit for us by being that, by adapting to salt water. And more interestingly, they have specialized root systems, which is the characteristics of mangrove because of the site that they are in, with the tidal activities, with soft sediment, anoxic sediment, and aerobic sediment. So they adapt by forming these specialized root systems, which allow them to absorb salt water and then excrete salt from their body.
Wow.
They don't need salt to grow, to live. But they are doing this for us, like defending us by adapting to this ecosystem. And then another thing is their specialized reproductive mechanism. Mm-hmm. Okay, so being at between land and sea, there is a tidal activity going on every day. Especially in Malaysia, we have semi-diurnal situation where we have two high tides and two low tides every day. It happens twice every day. So they need to adapt to this, right? So young plants, I mean, the seed, yeah, the baby of mangrove, actually is attached to their parents until they are ready to become a tree. So they are not released as a seed like durians, like other fruits. So they grow to be a young adult, attached to the parents, and when they are ready to be independent, the parents will release them. But then at the same time, they have this ability to float or to be buoyant for a long time. Mm-hmm. Again, because of this tidal activity, so they can float and then take root somewhere suitable. Normally, it's within a few radius from the parent, but they may travel quite a distance.
Okay.
But then another point that was my finding and my supervisor's finding at that time, Norms, at risk reproductive mechanism actually lead, it actually provide a mechanism for mangrove to regenerate naturally. You will seldom see mangrove grow like a really old and huge. Yeah, because if they grow old and huge, they tend to fall because of the soft sediment.
Sure.
So, this is a mechanism where, of course, catalyzed by some nature disturbances, it allows for mangrove to rejuvenate itself naturally.
Wow.
So the turnover is quite fast, so 30 to 70 years, we will get new forests. And that's why, if you go on board, cruising on board, looking at mangroves, you will find like a similar height and similar size of trees. And then this actually one of my research, one of my publication, I summarized mangrove as the forever young ecosystem. So these are some of the characteristics of mangrove.
They sound amazingly resilient and like such amazing plants.
They are,
trees,
yes.
And
yes, the unique characteristic actually amazed a lot of scientists, and yeah.
But okay, so the plants is like, who kind of, you know, lives among there? What sort of organisms do we find within mangrove?
Yeah, good question. I mean, like, not just plants are unique. That's why I renewed some of the definition for mangrove habitat or mangrove forest or mangrove ecosystem. Not just plant, but they are also inhabited by unique animals. The most unique, the mudskipper. This is an iconic species for mangrove, I would say. So they are able to live in water and outside water.
Sure.
So and then mollusks, bivalves, fish. Talking about fish, you see, like mangroves are the sanctuary, breeding habitat, spawning habitat for coral fishes.
Oh.
So I mean, occasionally you may find dolphins, pink dolphin, dugong grazing on seagrasses just adjacent to mangrove. But then some other mangroves, they have iconic species like in Borneo. In our mangroves in Borneo, we have proboscis monkey. And then in Sundarban mangroves in between Bangladesh and India, that is the largest piece of mangrove, by the way, in the world. They have Royal Bengal tiger making mangrove as their habitat, living in mangrove. So
mangrove,
it's very interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
So, okay, so it grows in an intertidal zone, that's what it's called, right?
Yeah.
So between water and land, is that?
In between the highest astronomical tide and the lowest tide.
Okay.
So this is their preferred place. So, yeah.
So how are they so, I guess, what makes them so resilient? How do they manage to survive such hostile conditions?
All right. Going back to their morphology and physiology of their bodies and adaptation to this ecosystem. Yeah, this is a point I would relate to their ability to move with the zone.
The zones, right.
Okay, now that we were talking about global climate change, increase in sea level. So they have this ability to go with this zone, right? So they are better at colonizing, any areas. They are suitable, but of course, there are preferred characteristics or sediment that they would prefer. And then, when we talk about sea level rise, they will move together or along with the movement or the increase or decrease of mean sea level. So this is an interesting point that I want to highlight in the management or conservation of mangrove. All right, so they themselves, mangroves, are buffer or protector of this coastline. But at the same time, to conserve mangrove, they themselves need some buffer to allow for this nature process to happen. Because they move, they are highly adaptive to their ecosystem, to their surrounding. So when sea level rise, they will move landward. And then if sea level decreases or there are sedimentation process happening seaward, so they are able to actually propagate.
Okay.
So we gain land that way. So yeah, this process needs to be allowed. So what's happening mostly in our country and our region is that we build seawalls or bunds behind mangroves. So there's no way for
them to move.
There you go.
But I think as with everything else, we are losing our mangroves.
Yeah, I mean, it happened not just in Malaysia. It's actually, I would say it's a regional and global thing.
Mm-hmm.
Malaysia and Southeast Asia is a center for distribution of species, of mangrove species. In fact, in ecological studies, the whole world is divided into two. So on our side, it's Indo-West Pacific, or some would call the old world. And then on Atlantic East Pacific, the New World. So we were divided into these two. So ecologically, in the West Pacific, our region in particular is the center for distribution with highest number of species, with the largest area of mangrove.
Okay.
So we are very proud of that. But at the same time, especially since the mid-50s, I mean, many countries within our region gain independence, and then they start building up their economy. Population start to shoot. That was the point where mangrove reforestation started rapidly, especially in Malaysia. Like we plan for an economic expansion, economic development for the country. So we pursued on agriculture and aquaculture at that time. So these actually needed land, right? So they tend to change mangrove into agriculture. So that was a turning point. And up until now, quite a vast number of mangrove, but we still do have, actually Malaysia, based on the global database, is ranked third as the third largest mangrove holding nation in the world.
Okay.
Although the number declined, but since I have a graph showing that starting, it was during the tsunami. So there was an increase since 2000 to 2010. And I reckon because 2005, we started preserving and we started replanting as well.
Mm-hmm.
So actually the graph showed in the opposite direction starting 2000. So,
So, I mean, just to go on that point, you know, I think a lot of us only realize the importance of mangroves, you know, when the tsunami hit, and scientists like you came out and said, because you cut the mangroves, our buffer zone was
exactly,
gone.
Yeah.
Maybe you could explain that for
sure.
Those who don't know.
Because mangrove naturally does this for us, like for ages. Like they are there for a reason, like being a shelter, being a buffer, being a protector, a defender of coastlines. So, and then this was also the reason why some of the, most of all actually, tropical coastal towns started. Because access to water, access to water transportation, resources that they provide, and then the shelter that they provide also. But actually, they sacrifice themselves for us, you see. Like, we do have tidal surges. We do have, actually, Malaysia is so lucky that we are out of the Pacific Ring of Fire. Like, we don't have earthquake, we don't have volcano eruption, but we know that it happened before in 2004. It may happen again.
Yeah.
And unexpected disasters could happen too. So climatic hazards, geological hazards, it could happen. So A good example would be, may sound weird to say good, but like Typhoon Haiyan in Philippines, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so they did have mangrove before that in the Philippines, but of course it was deforested and a lot of mangrove forest loss. So when Haiyan hit Philippines and other countries within that area, not just the human towns and cities vanished, including the mangrove, to show how extreme the impact was. In that particular situation, post-disaster, then we may need to assist their regeneration. All right, so say they sacrifice, but then they need help as well because they are fragile.
Yeah.
And although they look like really scary, really strong, really macho, but they are actually very fragile too. Yeah.
Okay. So, and another point I forgot to bring up is how they are actually very efficient in terms of sequestering carbon dioxide.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is the in thing now, actually.
Yeah. Climate change, right?
Yeah. I mean, the process, of course, has been happening since the start of everything. But, this is an invisible process that we cannot see. There are carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, but this is the beauty of science. I mean, we managed to describe these processes, right? Okay, so with increase in carbon dioxide, emissions, the amount of carbon in atmosphere is increasing and it actually leads to global warming, mm-hmm. global sea surface temperature, global heated ocean. So the only way to fix carbon is by the process of photosynthesis.
Sure.
All right, so trees are able to do that. We can't. We don't need CO2 to live. But then comparing all types of forests, all types of green plants, mangrove has the ability to the most efficient to fix carbon, right? Given that their physiology to absorb more, and then the ability of the ecosystem to trap or to keep or to sequester this carbon. It's a combination of factors, actually, not just the plants. Actually, crabs do help in the process. You see, like, okay, plants absorb carbon dioxide, and then they shed their leaves. So the crab will then grab the leaf to make their burrows, right? Mm-hmm. To patch on the walls of their burrows. So this actually helps the process, and it is being kept. All this carbon are being kept in the ground, in the soil, for years and years and years and years. It accumulated, so that's why they are the most efficient. All right. So, but then talking about crab, this is also an indicator. Whenever the next time you visit mangrove, normally you won't see that many leaf litter because the detritus cycle actually allow crab to feed on these leaves, I mean fallen leaf, and then use them to make their burrows. So if you see a lot of leaf without crabs, that is an indicator of unhealthy mangrove. Okay. All right, so there you go about carbon sequestration. They have the ability, and it's proven scientifically to be 4 times better than in terrestrial forests. With mangrove with the combination with seagrass ecosystem and salt marshes, we don't have that much salt marshes. So these three ecosystems are being categorized or grouped as blue carbon ecosystem. Sure. So this is a lot of research is going on as we speak. So, and I have a couple of friends delving into carbon.
Okay.
And I'm assisting them most of the time, yep.
Because I think I was reading that, you know, mangrove loss is actually, some consider it worse for the climate than actually rainforest loss, right?
Exactly, yeah. Okay, so there you go. This is the issue. Mangrove is the most efficient plant or habitat to absorb, to fix carbon dioxide. But then at the same time, okay, this is the risk of deforestation of mangroves. So we cut, tree, the ability to absorb, gone. But if we change the land use, mm-hmm. we change mangrove, we will emit, they will emit a lot of carbon that has been stored for hundreds, thousands of years.
Oh,
so yeah, that is the risk. So that's why, I mean, like when we deforest mangrove, because it's invisible, you don't see. Okay, you see it turn into a pond, you see it turn into a resort, but then you don't see the carbon being oxygenated and become carbon dioxide. So yeah, that is the risk, and this must be taken care of.
Okay. So it sounds like the leading cause of mangrove deforestation is humans.
Yeah, of course. Of course, yeah.
To put it mildly.
Yeah.
That is the main cause, I suppose, for tourism, for business.
All right. So this is my favorite topic, actually, disturbances in mangrove.
Sure.
Okay, in ecological studies, there are natural disturbances. There are agents that actually cause mangrove to be disturbed, any forest to be disturbed for that matter. But then there is a purpose of an ecosystem being disturbed. Like I mentioned earlier, a disturbance like lightning strikes or insect herbivory, for example, they actually attack or kill trees or a group of trees to allow for natural regeneration to happen.
Sure. Okay,
so that was my PhD, actually. So lightning strike disturbances. So this actually create a means for seedlings, for baby mangrove to grow, because most of the species are shade intolerant, because under the canopy, they cannot grow further. But again, the parent sacrificed or died because of disturbances, allowing the baby to grow and replace their place. In a beautiful cycle, I would say, the parent died gracefully to allow for new regeneration to grow. Okay, but nature disturbances are good. But not the extreme ones, of course.
Yeah. Okay,
but then, human disturbances, we are always the culprit. Anthropogenic impacts. Eh? So
yes.
We do disrupt changes, rapid change to the mangrove, and they won't have the ability to
regenerate.
Yeah. Okay, so for example, like if we turn it into a pond, and then, for example, like after 5 or 6 years of being a pond, and then it will be abandoned. In some cases, they are abandoned. Mangrove will have hard time. They have to strategize to regrow or to recolonize this area. So at that point, we may need to provide assisted regeneration for the mangrove. See, like mangrove restoration does not mean we plant or replant. There are a lot of strategies. We need to consider the hydrology of the area and then suitable plants or suitable sediment for each species to plant. And then if you turn it into resort, surely turn into housing. I mean, they're just gone just like that, right?
Yeah.
So, with carbon being emitted because of land clearing and then putting people, putting buildings there, so, there's no chance for them to recover. And we are actually contributing to the increased carbon dioxide and heat to the world,
And all the other effects of climate change, like, weather patterns and things like that.
Yeah, it's a chain reaction.
Chain reaction, So that was Dr. Ahmad Altri Amir, a senior lecturer and research fellow at the Institute of Environment and Development at Universiti Kebangsaan Malaysia and the coordinator of the Malaysian Mangrove Research Alliance and Network, also known as My Mangrove. It was World Wetlands Day yesterday, so we were revisiting some past interviews we've done to help us understand the importance of wetlands. And if you'd like to hear any of those interviews in full, you can head to bfm.my/earth to search for the podcast, or you can also head to the BFM app or also Spotify to hear that or any previous Earth Matters interviews. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.